Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday. It is the 20th of October. I hope you are all well. I hope you had a beautiful weekend. I hope you enjoyed what, at least in my part of the region, was gorgeous and beautiful and really perfect for whatever activity you may have planned, and I hope you enjoyed it to the fullest extent. I want to get into the show right away and introduce all of our wonderful guests. I first, though, want to just thank the incredible folks at Bard College and specifically at the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities on the campus of Bard. We did our show there on Friday, and it was we broadcast from their Joy Conference, Loving the World in Dark Times. It was really an amazing program. There were no, look, I will tell you, maybe not on the radio, but I would tell you in person, like what the bad parts were. But there were really none this time. Like, you know, usually there's like one soft spot and you're like, oh, I wish that had gone. This was great.
I listened to a little bit of it.
It was so good and so, I hope, uplifting, and I thought it was a job well done. My thanks to the entire crew at Bard. My thanks to our entire crew for making it happen. I especially want to thank one individual, and that one individual is Kayla Sacco. Kayla was on the list of people for me to thank, and it was a handwritten list, and for the life of me, I could not read the writing, and I had no idea. And I didn't see enough letters to even know that that was Kayla. So I completely screwed that up at the end of the show. And I just want to thank Kayla for the wonderful work that she did. She took amazing pictures. She did wonderful posts. And she is just a joy to have on those broadcasts. And I thank her from the bottom of my heart. And I apologize for the name screw up. I like to know the names of people that work on our show, and I felt really embarrassed that I didn't.
Oops.
And I love Kayla. She's so good. But so my apologies to her. And just please know that even if you don't hear her name, she is here in a shining light and doing wonderful, wonderful work. All right. Let me now wonderful is the word to describe these panelists as well. And we'll introduce them to you and we'll get started. We didn't have Friday's show, so we have a lot to talk about. Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College, Robert Brigham is here. Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, Joe. Always good to be here.
Wonderful to have you here. We've missed this guy, and he brought us donuts today in a really sweet gesture. John Faso is with us, former New York 19th Congressman and New York Assemblyman. Hello, sir. How are you?
Good morning. Great to be back. Sorry I missed you in September, but scheduling made it very difficult, but great to be back here in October.
We are always happy when you are here, so thank you very much for doing that. I'll tell you, last time we had this gentleman on, we screwed up the schedule and we told him to come an hour later than he was supposed to, which is a mean thing that you do for people that you really don't want to have come to your party. And but unfortunately, we wanted this guy to come to our party, so we only spoke for a little bit, and I said, please give us another shot. Associate Professor of Music at Vassar College, Justin Patch is with us, studies music and American politics, sound studies, East Asian art music, and music in the African diaspora. It is an absolute thrill to welcome Justin back to the show. How
are Thanks
you?
For having me back, man. I'm doing great.
Great. Thank you very much for being here. And political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post is with us. The world is on its axis and spinning as it should because Libby is here.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I am here.
Yes. Yeah. Well, wonderful to have you all.
Yeah, it's been a little bit, but all is good.
Good. All is good, and that's all we really can ask for. Okay, so let's go to the news and start off today with what is happening. And one of the things that I wanted to begin with, I think, is Sunday's violence that happened in Gaza. And this, the New York Times covering this, their headline, "This weekend's violence in Gaza shows how fragile the ceasefire really is. Sunday's violence was short-lived, but analysts expect more clashes between Israel and Palestinian militants to put the truce under strain." 10 days into a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, relief is giving way to grim acknowledgments of the truce's tenuousness and of the need for continued outside intervention to keep it alive, let alone to make further progress. A new round of violence on Sunday showed just how arduous the road to a broader agreement in Gaza will be between the two sides, which have repeatedly accused each other of violating the truce. Two Israeli soldiers were killed and another was wounded when Palestinian militants launched an anti-tank missile at an army vehicle. The Israeli military said the attack took place in Rafah in southern Gaza on the Israeli-held eastern side of the ceasefire line. Israel called it a blatant violation of the agreement's terms. Hamas officials were quick to disavow the attack. This from, again, the New York Times updated at 6:55 this morning. Bob.
Well, peace agreements are notoriously difficult. I'm not surprised that there's been violence. This is the nature of them. This peace agreement, I think, will be even more difficult than most because it didn't have the ramp-up time. If we look at the 20 points, they're more almost like back-of-the-envelope points rather than actual linkage. And that's what you need in a peace agreement to have sustainable peace. You need linkage. And the linkage that's here is not the kind of linkage that you would expect to see in a ceasefire, interim constitution, sustainable peace agreement. There's nothing, for example, that links decommissioning of the AQM to anything that they want politically. And we know that peace agreements usually work, like the Good Friday Agreement or the South African Agreement. They usually work when the belligerents think they're going to get more of what they want by staying in the process. And they need enforcement mechanisms. And the other thing that they desperately need is to link the political aspirations of the belligerents with the decommissioning and standing down. There's only one of the 20 points that deals with that at all. And in my view, it links the wrong things. It links the decommissioning of Hamas, which is absolutely necessary, but it links it with amnesty. And I think you need a heavier hand there. Instead of linking it with amnesty, that would be more on a prisoner exchange. You need to link this with any kind of political future in the region to have it act as a self-enforcing enforcement mechanism. So I think we have a long road ahead. I wouldn't be surprised if this low-level, low-intensity, long-duration violence continues. They've seemed to like recalibrated and want to restart the clock, but this is the nature of peace agreements. They're going to do this a few times. And then maybe there can be some more meetings where you actually get down to the kind of things that you really need to be present in an agreement for it to have legs.
Libby?
Well, you know, we're dealing with a group of Palestinians who are not the nation state, right? And you have some of these other agreements. It's always been with a nation state. You know, Egypt, Jordan. We were going to have something with Saudi Arabia, but I guess on October 10th or something like that. I mean, it was right there where Israel and Saudi Arabia was going to create some kind of agreement. I don't see that this stopping anytime soon. I think the ultra-right wing in Israel, I mean, Smotrich said in one word on X, you know, war. They want to keep this going. The people of Israel do not. We've seen it on the streets. We've seen it in commentary. But I think it's going to be very difficult for there to be this lasting peace as long as each side is rooted in hate and the desire to totally annihilate one another.
John Faso.
Well, I think Bob laid out the problem pretty succinctly and very well. From my vantage point, I think that you have irreconcilable differences between Israel and Hamas. I don't think, and I separate Hamas from the Palestinians. in that regard. You saw how the Hamas brutally executed about 9 or 10 Palestinian adversaries within another clan shortly after the agreement was announced. And I think until Hamas is disbanded and disarmed, I think it's going to be very, very difficult. So the question will come as to what the Qataris and the Turks, what kind of pressure they can bring, because I believe until the leadership of Hamas is removed from Gaza, whether it's self-exile or something more violent, that and until Hamas itself actually disarms, I don't know that this problem is going to go away. And I think that that's ultimately the problem. The question will be, in my view, how the other Arab co-signers or parties to this agreement that the president had a week or so ago in Egypt, how do the Turks, how do the Saudis, how do the Qataris, how do they address this question? Because until Hamas is effectively removed, I don't see that there will be a lasting peace.
Justin?
So my feeling about this, I mean, apart from what you know, my colleagues have said already, is that, you know, Hamas won an election almost 20 years ago, and there hasn't been another one. And so you have a body that you're negotiating with that does not have a popular mandate. That is not a recipe for a long, sustained solution, let alone the issue that Bob brought up, is that these peace accords that last are typically years and years in the making, not 6 months in the making. So you have two factors here about negotiating with a political entity that does not have a popular mandate or a very good track record of governance, and then guidelines for a ceasefire and peace agreement that are, you know, ideas more than they are actually the nitty-gritty of how diplomacy works. This is not a recipe for anything that lasts long, that people feel good about. And ultimately, it is going to have to be popular sentiment on both sides, with people agreeing, hey, we need to end hostilities, and this is how we can see a path forward. And I don't think you can see a path forward with Hamas, with a peace accord that's not well drawn out, and with, frankly, a government in Egypt that's not particularly popular and is not paying attention to popular will. Those things are not a recipe for success.
There is one moment here, I think, that's interesting to the historian in me, and that is, if we look back to Oslo, one of the failures of Oslo was that President Clinton overpromised what he could deliver through Yasser Arafat and then eventually to the Palestinian Authority. And that, in a sense, is what gave Hamas the opening. Nobody could see on the horizon that there was this generational rift within the Palestinian movement. And so, you know, I'm not an expert on this area at all, but I'm wondering if the people who are seeing another opportunity for the ground to shift under the feet of Hamas, who certainly has some legitimacy issues among many Palestinians. There may be a moment here, while we're looking at this big picture thing, that on the ground, the politics might be shifting in ways that would present opportunity that we just haven't been able to surface yet.
But I think you also run into the same issue where, if you look at both leadership in Hamas and leadership on the West Bank, they tend to be the much older generation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
there may be
movements among 20 and 30 year olds that nobody who's at the table has the pulse on.
Yeah.
And that's a problem.
Here's a really cynical thing to say, but you know, if they're wandering around on the ground and seeing opportunities, will they realize they're seeing them?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question, Joe. And how do you bake that into the DNA of an agreement where you need to decommission and you have to decommission? It's tricky work.
The big difference, though, now compared to where we were 2 years ago, shortly after the attack on Israel, is that Hamas and its guardians, namely Iran and its brethren, Hezbollah, and to some extent the Houthis in Yemen, they've been effectively defanged. And so Hamas is in a much weaker institutional position because those that provided financing and support to them, including the Israelis who helped finance through the Qataris the so-called redevelopment for Hamas in Gaza, which Hamas then diverted towards military uses and tunnels, etc. That is all gone. It's all different. So I think Hamas has a much weaker hand to play here. And again, I think it comes back to the Qataris and the Turks and the Saudis in particular as to what the next step is with Hamas.
We'll take a break. We'll continue this discussion. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We look forward to hearing from you and having you join in the discussion. We'll continue our conversation after this short break and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this morning. We very much appreciate you being with us. You can join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We are talking about this weekend's violence in Gaza and how that is showing how fragile the ceasefire really is. We heard from our panel members. We do have letters. I'd like to get to those unless anybody has another point you'd like to make. All right, let's go to the letters then. And we begin with John. I may be naive, but I don't understand what group is the enemy of Israel. Is it Hamas? Is it Palestinian militants or both? Is it not one of the goals to wipe out Hamas, or is it to destroy the militants, or are they one and the same? That from John.
They're one and the same.
Mm-hmm. Gary writes, how can you keep peace in Israel when the Trump peacemaker outwardly says that Gaza must be totally taken out? That is from Gary. Then we go to Ed. Hamas is a vicious, violent group of criminal thugs who will murder Palestinians as readily as they will Jews. Who will control them, much disarm them? It's not even clear that the IDF can do the job. What is really perplexing is how Western leftist protesters and politicians can credibly support such groups.
I don't think any politician supports Hamas. I think that's a misnomer. I think that most people recognize who they are. The question is, how do you get a different set of leadership in there? And let's be honest, like the PA on the West Bank has not done a much better job at governance. And so I think that's the issue, is how do you find a political party that actually has their people's best interests in mind? And I think that's been a bit of the challenge.
That's why I come back to the nations that have sustained and supported both the Palestinian Authority and Hamas in recent years. And you come back to the Turks and the Saudis and Qataris, who apparently have now, based upon President Trump's agreement and negotiation with them and with Israel, agreed that Hamas should be disarmed and removed as a effective force within Gaza. That's the $1,000 question as to how will you disarm them and what role will those countries have. I just come back to show me the money, and the money is what they have used to sustain these terrorist organizations such as Hamas and Hezbollah. And now, because of the Israeli counteroffensive against these organizations, they've effectively been defanged. So the money is not going to be there for Hamas going forward. So I just don't see that there's much future for them as long as the money is cut off.
Although, I mean, I think that's the issue that we see in Latin America, is you end up with narco states because that's right. Where the money comes from.
They'll end up with somebody giving them money. I'm not too worried about that. What I am worried about is the writer's perspective that you can have this blanket statement mm-hmm. about Democrats and everyone from the Democratic Party over to the progressive community, because it's simply not true.
Yeah. But I think you have to show, there was an op-ed written some years back, and you said, you know, the key to ending a lot of this is showing angry young men that there's a different way to exist. And I think that's very, very, very true for Gaza and for the West Bank, right? Young, disenfranchised men, if the option in front of them is picking up arms, that's what's going to happen.
That's why I think there's got to be more work done on the political side of this, mm-hmm. on the linkage between being brought in from the cold and having a viable path to a future of political life. When Clinton gave Gerry Adams the visa to come to the United States, he could very clearly see a way to raise money for a political front, you know, to give Sinn Féin real teeth. And so it was possible to decommission the IRA. So they've got to have the same kind of dangling fruit, I think, on the political side of this agreement.
We go back to the letters. Dan writes to us and says, earlier it was said that Bill Clinton overpromised in the 90s when negotiating a truce between Israel and Palestine, and that gave rise to Hamas. Can anyone on the panel elaborate on how those negotiations failed? I'm wondering if a hard line by Israel had anything to do with it. It's unfortunate that analysis on the subject is often so lopsided, given that it's been going on for so long through so many different leadership regimes. You know what they say, it takes two to tango.
Well, I mean, the Israelis in those Clinton negotiations, they had made, the Americans with Bill Clinton and the Israelis made commitments, and Yasser Arafat famously failed to follow through. He had an opportunity. In fact, there were multiple opportunities. I'm reminded of the famous quote of the late Foreign Minister of Israel, Abba Iban, who said, "The Arabs never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity." And they missed a lot of opportunities for a permanent settlement. There was a two-state solution that Israel was ready to agree to back in 2000 and in 2002, and Yasser Arafat, and for whatever reasons, they declined.
And there was a two-state solution ready in 1948. And all the Arab countries surrounding this little spit of land declined.
Went to war.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think that, we'll probably be talking about this a year from now and 5 years from now. But again, I think—
Job security.
Yeah, right.
I think that the key here and the big difference is that they don't have the support of Iran, because they've been effectively defanged, at least for the time being. And certainly the Hezbollah and their cancerous status in the nation state of Lebanon has been effectively defanged, and their military abilities have been effectively defanged. And so Hamas does not have the normal coterie of supporters and financial backers that they had pre-October 7th, 2023.
Bob Brigham.
Yeah, I think what I meant with Clinton overpromising, I think that the Clinton team, and I think Dennis Ross would agree with this, they thought that Yasser Arafat was going to, one, deliver, but two, could deliver. And that was the problem, is that I think probably politically he understood that he was losing the next generation by not having any kind of agreement, any kind of political future for what would become the PA, Palestinian Authority, and that he didn't have that kind of control over the next generation rising up that Clinton wanted him to have or thought he had. And that's what I meant by overpromising. I mean, Clinton put an awful lot of eggs in the Arafat basket that then got broken. And that's one of the reasons we're here where we are. I mean, I want to go back to something that Justin said and something that John said. I mean, the great unknown here is, how's this next generation of Palestinians going to behave?
Right.
And I think that's right. So essential that we find some kind of framework for participation in public life, or else it's going to be more of the same.
Let's go back to letters and David, who says, no offense to your esteemed panelists, but anyone who believes that the quote-unquote peace plan was anything but window dressing to allow for the release of Israeli prisoners is fooling themselves.
Israel will now proceed with the process of flattening Gaza, removing the Palestinians, and moving full steam ahead with the Riviera on the sea, Trump and Netanyahu's plan. That from David. Then we go to Norma with further validation. So disappointing to hear about the roundtable responses to a genocide. The genocide was not about October 7th and Hamas. That is why they are killing Palestinians in the West Bank. For real peace, Israel has to stop genocide and ethnic cleansing. Palestinians must have a state. America must stop arming Israel. U.S. politicians must stop taking AIPAC money, and media must stop whitewashing the apartheid state. That from Norma.
And I think Norma is totally wrong about the allegation of genocide. I mean, that I think that that's an outrageous slander against Israel. There haven't been too many instances of a nation at war with an enemy which gives the civilian population in an area notice that's time to leave this area, or a nation at war with an enemy that sends food supplies into the beleaguered population. I mean, this is, unfortunately, Hamas, their modus operandi is to instill themselves in the civilian population, and they could care less how many Palestinians die because they have exposed them to harm. And that really is what is going on here and what has gone on. And unfortunately, the writer also exposes what is unfortunately a major growing trend within the left in this country to castigate Israel and to make just outrageous allegations against the Jewish state. They're fighting for their national survival. They've been surrounded by adversaries since 1948, and many, unfortunately, now on the left have subscribed to this notion that from the river to the sea means the expungement of the Jewish state. And you see this in Zoran Mamdani's comments that he doesn't believe in that Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state. And mind you, this speck of land, a homeland to the Jewish people, is surrounded by Islamic states and Muslim states. But he doesn't seem to object to Saudi Arabia or the other nations around there being Muslim states, you know, not exactly beneficent towards either Christians or Jews. So, I mean, I think that this falsehood, this lie that is continually repeated that Israel has committed genocide, really needs to be thoroughly exposed and shown for what it is, which is really an attack on the legitimacy of the Jewish state and a desire to see that state extinguished.
I think, once again, we need to be very careful about such a broad brush defining who you might think the left is, John, because I don't agree with those statements that you are ascribing to everyone on the left, and I am on the left, so I'm left of center, that's for sure. You know, this is one of those situations where I don't support the Israeli government, but I support Israel's right to exist. I don't support the U.S. government right now, but I certainly support the United States' right to exist. I think the issue, going back to the fact that there is no nation state to negotiate with, it's just a bunch of terrorists on the Hamas side who, John, you're right, will put their people, put the people that they're supposedly protecting in harm's way to further their own political agenda.
Has Israel committed a genocide, Libby?
No.
Exactly.
Okay, I don't think
so. You and
so,
I agree with that.
Yes, we do agree on that, because I think it's it's one of those words that create triggers for a lot of different people. What has happened in Gaza is a humanitarian crisis. It's not a good thing. I would not have suggested that this is the way it came down. You know, I think we have to be careful with the words that we choose, just like people have to be careful with a wide brushstroke about what the left thinks. We also have to be careful about the historical context of these words and what they really do mean. This is war, okay? It's just that simple. We're in a state of war. Israel's fighting against an entity that has no problem putting children out front, has no problem having headquarters underneath hospitals. They have no problem with not engaging in what those of us who learned about World War II would see as the rules of war, right? And we just have to be very careful on the language that we use and the fact that while I don't support what Israel has done in the last 18 months, I think Israel had every right to defend itself after October 7th, but it's taken it to a point where, look, this is about keeping Netanyahu out of jail. When you really want to get down to it, that's what this is about. He was paying more attention pre-October 7th to taking over the Supreme Court in Israel and making it a puppet of the right wing than he was to the Israeli borders. People were saying, there's something going on, there's something going on. Women's organizations, I read it over the weekend, were saying there's something going on. Nobody wanted to pay attention to those warnings, and then we had October 7th.
Well, we have to also remember that this situation is not two nations at war. This is a political party with a militia fighting against a nation. This is not... It's hard to draw an equivalence to something in our own history that would look the same way, short of the Revolutionary War, right? So genocide seems like a weird thing. I mean, war crimes... You could probably talk about that because bombing a hospital technically is a war crime, right? There have been incidents that are clearly war crimes. But this is not – this is also not something – and I sort of hate that people talk about taking sides. I ran up on a colleague of mine who studies music in the Middle East and lived in the occupied territories for a couple of years. And I said, you know, Dave, where are you at right now? And he was like, everybody is a jerk. Like the people who govern the Gaza Strip are well, he didn't say jerk, but I'll censor myself. He's like, they're jerks.
Sounds like our staff meetings. Yeah.
The Israeli government, like, they're not representing the people. Like, they're jerks. And so you have there is no good side. There's no clear black and white. There's like, oh no, these guys are the good guys, those guys are the bad guys. It's time to have a public discourse that actually is really nuanced, that's not reduced to sound bites and 144 characters or less. Like, that's what this situation calls for. And anybody who steps in front of a microphone and says two sentences is either willfully ignorant or lying to you.
We'll pause there. We have a lot more letters to get to. We'll do that on the other side of a break. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion this morning. And going back to letters before the top of the hour, and then we'll move on to other subjects on the other side of a news break. Although we have all continued to pray for peace in the Middle East, writes Diane, this has never been a one-and-done situation. Thinking that this is a business deal is a fool's errand. You're talking about centuries of strife and its reason that is still facing the world, and more importantly, the Palestinians and the Israeli state. That from Diane. Then we go to this letter from Jade. The Israeli government, shouty caps, has committed genocide, no doubt, shouty caps. It is not the Israeli people. How dare you dismiss it as anything else? Then we go to Matthew. I think it's interesting that the same people who would be vehemently opposed to a Christian state here in the U.S. are defending a Jewish state in Israel. A true democracy has no place for religious laws. Unfortunately, Israel makes policy based upon religious directives. Then we go to a letter. Let's see.
That letter kind of ignores the fact that here in the United States, for instance, the founders were influenced heavily by their religious belief, and the Judeo-Christian tradition and ethics is heavily imbued in our laws and our statutes and our judicial processes here in the United States. So to suggest that somehow we are divorced from the impact of religion and religious tradition, I think, is just simply false.
Let's see. We go to Jared. The Jewish people in what was Palestine, made into Israel by force, wouldn't be surrounded by enemies had they not violently displaced 700,000 Palestinians by force. If foreigners took over an American state by force, would you just call the state theirs once they successfully invaded? Then we go to...
I would also point out in Israel, which is a democracy, Arabs and non-Jews are able to participate in governance. They're citizens. They serve in parliament, in the Knesset, etc. So unlike many of their Arab neighbors, there are rights of minorities within the state of Israel.
Okay, here we go, John. Tracy writes, maybe Mr. Faso could have included the Young Republicans group chat, just exchanged those horrific text messages about Jews and black people, and supporting Hitler, the J.D. Vance and Elise Stefanik just laughed off as kids joking around. They are not kids, they are men, and maybe include them when you're talking about groups that are anti-Jewish.
Well, whataboutism is something that plagues people on both sides of the political argument, and that's what plagues that writer. I would point out that genocide is the deliberate and systematic destruction of a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group in whole or apart, and that is certainly not what Israel has done in its war in Gaza. I would also point out that in World War II, for instance, the United States engaged in incendiary bombing, for instance, of Japan. In one night, there were 80,000 people killed because we deliberately dropped incendiaries on Tokyo. And we knew that that would affect civilians. But it was an effort to, of all-out war, and in war, terrible things happen. To suggest that Israel engaged in a wholesale and systematic effort to destroy the population is belied by the facts. You don't feed your enemy. You don't not drop warning leaflets to people saying you're in danger if you stay here. Please leave, as they did in Rafah, for instance, when the Biden administration didn't want them to go into Rafah in the war. And that was a mistake Israel made, paying attention to the Biden administration early on in the war. So Libya is correct. The careless and gratuitous use of the term genocide is something that people need to really reconsider.
Okay, so I would like you to give me a digital file of just those words from John. Libby is correct. I can, it'll be great for me to hear it every so often.
Well, you could put it on your voicemail.
As you're
answering.
Yes, yeah.
If I could pull a couple of threads together here.
Yes, please.
The issue with the Young Republicans, the issue with Hamas, and frankly, the issue with the Israeli government redeploying young men and women over and over and over again for 2 years, represents a really radical dismissal of the needs of young people. Right. I think the Republicans went ahead and got the loudest, angriest people to lead the Young Republicans rather than people who paid attention to what, 18 to 30 year olds needed. Hamas obviously is not educating people. It's not training people. They never had an economic plan for young men in Gaza other than to pick up arms and join them in order to get a paycheck for your family. And we see this with the Israeli government redeploying these young men and women, because both sexes, serve in the army, over and over, causing disruptions to their jobs, to their families, and frankly, to their economy. Like, all these things are tied together with the idea that as a 25-year-old, somebody else has say over your life that you do not. This is how people get disenfranchised, get angry, and then do things that are harmful to themselves and others.
All right. We have just under a minute. The one thing I want to get to, we get a lot of letters in this, and I just want to address the fact that we have gotten a lot of letters on this. I hope you're aware that Mr. Faso just blatantly misstated the position of Zohran Mamdani on Israel's right to exist. I hope someone will ask Mr. Faso to produce a statement, whether oral or written, from Mr. Mamdani on this particular matter.
He very clearly said that he doesn't think Israel should exist as a Jewish state. That is what he said. And His history on this whole issue is very disquieting, I think, and is to many Democrats.
It's probably not a good time to bring up that in international law, no state has the right to exist.
Well, there you go.
There you go.
Just end that debate right here. There is no statute.
Yeah. I did have, okay, and Zoran Mandami has not refused to recognize Israel as a state. What he said was they should be a state with equal rights for all citizens. This panel is showing its bias, painting the left as anti-Israel. As an entity, shame.
Didn't I just say that?
You all get lumped in together, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
All right.
My bad.
It's all right.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Robert Brigham is here, professor of history and international relations at Vassar College. John Faso, former New York 19th congressman and former New York assemblyman. Associate professor of music at Vassar College, Justin Patch, and political consultant and lobbyist, Libby Post. We welcome you as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We're going to move on and discuss other topics. And the, well, you can't start a week without talking about the shutdown, can you? The spending shutdown has highlighted Republicans' failure to produce an alternative to Obamacare, which many of them assail but concede is too politically risky to undo. The shutdown fight reopens debate in the GOP over the issue of health care. The federal shutdown is nearing its fourth week. There is no end in sight. There is political risk, certainly for the Democrats, who Republicans have accused of refusing to fulfill their responsibility to fund the government. But it has also thrust President Trump and the GOP onto the defensive on health care, an issue that has long been a major weakness for the party. Democrats in Congress are holding fast to their position that they will not agree to a spending deal unless Republicans include an extension of expiring Affordable Care Act tax credits that would stave off premium increases and the loss of coverage for millions of Americans. In doing so, they have forced the GOP to wrestle publicly with its divisions about what to do with the health care law, which most Republicans revile but many recognize would be impossible to unravel without bringing political disaster to their party. That from Annie Carney, writing for the New York Times. John Faso.
Well, I don't know about you, Joe, but I seem to recall that the pandemic has basically been over for a couple of years now. And these enhanced premium tax credits that were adopted, the extension of them that were temporarily adopted during the pandemic were intended to expire. It was intended to be just an inducement to make sure that people didn't lose health care coverage or were able to get health care coverage during the pandemic. The pandemic is over. And the original law said that people who were not eligible for Medicaid and who didn't have employer-provided health insurance would be able to buy health insurance through an ACA plan, an Affordable Care Act plan, if they had income between 125 and 150% of the poverty level. And during the pandemic, they extended that to basically anyone, including above 400% of the poverty level. So now we're dealing with an income of individual income of around $70,000. So these enhanced tax credits were supposed to expire. They were only done during the pandemic with an end date to them. And I think that the Democrats, frankly, are making a big political mistake by shutting the government down. What they could do would be to say, we'll keep funding the government, which, again, would be funded under the last Biden-era budget agreement because of the expiration of the or the continuing resolution that they're looking to extend funding is the funding that was based upon a Biden-era budget. So why they are putting the country through this government shutdown for tax credits that were supposed to expire and don't expire until December 31st, and tax credits that were only intended to be used for the, because of the pandemic, which has now been over for 2 years, I'm just befuddled by why the Democrats insist on shutting down the government in this juncture when they could be doing a continuing resolution to keep funding the government at the levels that were agreed to under the last Biden-era budget, and then negotiate how to deal with the expiration of the premium tax credits. And frankly, I think that the tax credits that were enacted just simply because of the pandemic, now that the pandemic is over, those enhanced tax credits should go away. Otherwise, it's a $380 billion cost over 10 years. Over 10 years to the federal government. And that's, frankly, I checked yesterday, the current year deficit is $1.75 trillion. And the current year cost of interest on the national debt is $1.25 trillion. We have a severe fiscal problem, and frankly, neither party is addressing it.
Bob? Well, I think there are several reasons why this has become an issue, a political issue. And one of them most clearly is that most of those who get subsidies live in red districts. And so this is a political wedge that Democrats can use. I also think that these subsidies were designed to disappear, but with inflation and with the inability of either party to get any kind of meaningful reform of the ACA, I think that the thought all along was that something would happen, and nothing has happened. There's right. been nothing put forward to replace the original, and this is the nut we find ourselves in. We find ourselves pinched here as a society, and I think it's kind of tragic that we can't do better for our people who need health care, and that it has become such a political lightning rod.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to follow policy and be like, great, when policy ends, it needs to get changed. But it's another thing to realize the human need. And the human need is that people need healthcare. Healthcare has gotten too expensive. It is inaccessible for many people. And it's been proven when you don't get regular checkups and you don't get regular healthcare, by the time you do need it, it exponentially outweighs what it would have cost for you to have had healthcare all along the way. So there's a real sort of public health issue where how do we get people covered? How do we get them taken care of? Which ultimately that's the job of the government, is to make sure that people get taken care of. And the fact that everyone's falling back on legislative language rather than realizing that there is a real human need for health care and health insurance, and that it is their job to make sure that that gets done. So rather than drafting up new legislation, we're fighting about what should or should not be in place, you know, 5, 10, 15 years after X legislation went in, is a gross dereliction of duty on the part of, frankly, both parties when it comes to this particular issue.
The other part of all of this is funding for community health centers is also at risk. And community health centers provide health care for those without, throughout the country, in red and blue areas. It doesn't really matter where you live. You know, if you need health care, you will get it at a community health center. And that funding is now at risk as well. So what's going to happen is, okay, so we're not going to have those tax credits, so people aren't going to be able to afford their health insurance. I don't really care if these came in before or after the pandemic. The fact of the matter is that they were needed, I think, before as well for a lot of people. So you're going to have those folks without health insurance. You're going to have people without community health centers to be able to go to. So what are people going to do? They're going to end up in the emergency room for primary care, which is going to drive up the costs for all of us. It's just that simple. When an emergency room is used for primary care, this is when we get into the biggest problems in terms of the cost of health care. You know, we can no longer afford to look at this as just a bottom line issue. You know, it's going to continue to cost us more and more money and drive the deficits up and up if we don't have a comprehensive way of dealing with health care in this country where everyone can get the care that they need. I'm lucky. I own a business. I'm on Medicare now. It's like, great, right? Who knows what's going to happen next year, whether or not there will still be Medicare. I have a feeling there will be because you don't want to screw around with senior citizens because we vote, right? So I know I'm lucky in this. There are plenty of people out there who are very unlucky and do not have the health care that they need, and they are struggling. My son, in order to get onto the exchange here in New York, so I'm not sure where the 80,000 or whatever you were talking about, John, the 400% of poverty. He had to take salary pay cut. He had to go below 40 in order to get health insurance on the exchange because of the way things have been structured. Mm-hmm. And he's a farmer. And so, by you guys, actually. So that, it's just, it doesn't make any sense for us to do what we're doing right now. And look, they're hurting people in the red states. One would think they'd like a bell would go off. But honestly, they really don't care. This is an administration who is hoping people die.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things. Like, one, if you want a dynamic.
I'm sorry, it's true.
No.
Libby, I mean, cutting funding for cancer research?
That's absurd.
It's absurd that they did that. They're cutting all kinds of health care funding. They don't care if poor people die. They don't care if people of color die. They don't care if women bleed out in parking lots. They just don't care.
Yeah. So, again, the shutting down the government is irresponsible, and that is on the Democrats for refusing to vote for a continuing resolution to keep the government open. These issues could be negotiated and debated, but in shutting down the government, it makes it very, very difficult to get anything accomplished. And basically holding the entire government hostage to a continuation of what was supposed to be temporary expansions of the tax credits because of the pandemic. This is one of the reasons why we're running such enormous deficits, why we're spending $1.25 trillion in interest on our debt, which is horribly wasteful, some can say we should continue all the pandemic era spending, which is clearly not affordable. And you know, Libby mentions community health centers. Well, they're jeopardized because of the government shutdown, not because of the argument over ACA tax credits.
When they want to whitewash the term healthcare disparities from laws, it gets a little difficult.
Well, the other thing about, and this is one of the things that bothers me about the conservative argument. All right, so I'm not sure how many people in government had this experience, but I've had to get a second job at points in my life when I'm like, hey, I'm working a full-time job, but it's not enough money, so I need to raise revenue, right? Usually when you don't have enough money to pay your bills, you raise revenue. And this government and most governments ahead of them have been loath to actually do something that would raise revenue. And I'm sorry, but when you want to have a nation of over 300 million people that maintains a military of our size, that has an infrastructure of our size, and that ideally would continue to have some sort of global influence, it takes money. It doesn't come for free. And if you're unwilling to raise revenue, then you have to really ask yourself, are you making wise decisions? Are you making adult decisions? Or is this some sort of ideology that's not connected to the lives of how people actually live?
This isn't a problem that is just arisen. Joe, where you and I come from, there was a wonderful rural hospital that served all of southern Washington County.
Yes.
And it closed. And this is symptomatic, I think, of what's wrong with the healthcare system in this country, is that poor people, rural people, don't have the quality access. And this is a debate that I think a country of our size and stature and brain power ought to be able to solve. And we just are not doing it.
Well, you know, this whole issue is a debate that's occurring across the Western world, frankly. You see in the UK, for instance, which has a government-sponsored health plan that is very popular, but it also is one that has a lot of financial problems. It has a lot of waiting lists. It has a lot of other issues that, you know, we're also recognizing the fact that our system has problems with it, to be sure. In fact, when Republicans, and I was in Congress in 17 when we tried to adapt a replacement for the ACA, one of the things that we supported and was in our plan were the precise thing we're talking about here, which are tax credits for people to help them buy private health insurance. And that's exactly a component of the Affordable Care Act that I think there's a lot of symmetry. Senator Bill Cassidy from Louisiana with Senator Hassan from New Hampshire, a Republican and a Democrat, they have plans that are addressing some of the waste and the inefficiencies in our current healthcare system. And there's bipartisan agreement on that. But you can't get a bipartisan agreement to move forward unless we open the government. And that's the problem. Chuck Schumer and the Democrats, because of their base, the reaction he had back in March when he allowed the continuing resolution to go forward back then, there was a tremendous, we don't want you to cooperate at all with anything that the Republicans are doing, anything that Trump is doing. And I think that's short-sighted on the part of the Democrats, because we could solve a lot of these issues, or at least address these issues in a bipartisan way, if they open the government. But they refuse to open the government, holding out for this one thing that doesn't expire until the end of the year. And again, these were pandemic-era spending increases that are no longer required because the pandemic is over. And why people think that we should continue the level of spending. When I was in Congress in 17 and 18, our budget was approximately $4.5 trillion. We're now over $7 trillion. And that level of spending cannot be sustained. You look at, Libby mentioned Medicare. Well, Medicare trustees, bipartisan, they're actuaries, they're green eyeshade guys, they point out that Medicare has severe financial problems, as does Social Security. And neither party is really addressing these issues. And that's, I think, the biggest problem here. But you can't do this unless we open the government.
But, John, you're forgetting that the Republicans also, I mean, when you think about the immigration bill that Biden had on the table, that was bipartisan negotiated in one phone call. The Republicans who were at the table negotiating pull back from the bill. So the deficit of trust is not just on the Democratic side. I think they have a very legitimate claim to look John Thune in the face and say, we don't trust you. And that's why we're not going to open up the government and just keep negotiating. That's garbage. Like, give us something on paper, because the trust is not there. I mean, John Thune was part of the party that was saying, if you even talk to Democrats, you're not one of us. And then he wants them to negotiate? That seems foolish and like an incredible case of historical amnesia.
Well, you can either keep the government closed and harm millions of people and affect negatively all these government agencies, including the Defense Department, or we could open up the government, allow people to get back to work, and negotiate these things going forward. And, you know, the filibuster is a marvelous tool, because you need 60 votes to proceed in the U.S. Senate. And that requires bipartisan cooperation. And it's very, I think, foolhardy of the Democrats just to say, well, we're not going to negotiate with you, and we're going to shut the government down. We're going to take our ball and go home, when all these issues are out there pending. Air traffic controllers, safety in agriculture department programs, et cetera. All of these things should be reopened so that we can move forward and negotiate. And just simply saying it's my way or the highway is not
but
the way to do it.
But I think the previous three shutdowns were all Republican engineered. So again, a great case of historical amnesia to say, well, the Democrats are doing something terrible this time. But the last three times, it was okay.
And I've never agreed with shutdowns. No. And I think that because history shows they wind up costing us more money,
yeah.
and mm-hmm. they're counterproductive. Yeah. When Ted Cruz got the House Republicans in 2013 to engineer a shutdown on the theory that Barack Obama could be persuaded to vote or to sign a bill repealing Obamacare, it was crazy. I mean, it was never going to happen. And it's at this point, I think we've the historical evidence is that both parties should have learned by now is that shutdowns don't move the process forward because it makes it impossible to negotiate.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Gary, a letter writer. The Dems, the reason the Dems are pushing health care because we have way worse health care and medical pricing than the other first world nations. That's from Gary. We got this letter from Peter. With what Assemblyman Faso just said, that the ACA will cost $380 billion over the next 10 years, that equates to $38 billion a year. Congress could easily afford that if the Republicans offered a one-year extension of those tax credits and then denied the $40 billion that Trump wants to give to Argentina as a bailout. So it actually saves the country $2 billion this year alone and give Americans health care. That from Peter. All right. We're just about, let me see here. We're right up against a break. Wondering if anyone knows what happened to all the money the government saved after all the older Americans who were on Medicare and Medicaid and nursing homes died prematurely. that from Bernadette. So how is that the shutdown is the Republicans' fault when every Senate Republican voted for the measure?
Plus three Democrats.
Enough Democrats in the House passed the resolution, and Democrats in the Senate will have to join the Republicans to pass something. Healthcare only got expensive when the government got involved in paying for it. Many years ago, NPR played actual recorded phone calls to President Johnson from Senator Stennis and Fulbright about the outrageous projected cost of Medicare at the time it was introduced for a vote. Johnson's advice to the concerned senators was not to tell anyone what Medicare would cost. Another example of the failures of the Great Society and war on poverty, the Affordable Care Act is anything but affordable. All right.
Well, one thing that some commentators have pointed out is that since the adoption of the Affordable Care Act, it is forced, because of financial reasons, it's forced more consolidation of hospitals and healthcare practices. And for instance, you can't find independent practices of doctors and physicians who are not because of insurance requirements, et cetera. And one of the factors of this kind of consolidation is the Affordable Care Act. I don't think that's entirely the reason, but it is one of those things that really does merit close examination because it's now impossible for physicians to practice independently anymore. If they're not in a hospital-based group, they basically are screwed, and they can't make the finances. So I just come back to the fundamental point. It makes no sense for us to engineer a government shutdown over a program, over these pandemic-era expansions of tax credits, which don't even expire until the end of the year. And there would be Democrats would have a much stronger basis to make this argument about those tax credits if they hadn't shut the government down. There's another aspect of this whole thing, too, which is that how do you get an ACA account? Often you go to a broker who has a financial incentive to sell you an account. And there's been documented evidence from the state of Florida, for instance, of brokers selling policies to individuals who don't even know they've got the policy because the brokers make a commission every time they sell a policy.
We are out of time. We'll take a quick break. You have to go.
Yep.
We love having you here. Thank you very much. We look forward to seeing you again soon. Thank you for the donuts. We'll be right back. People will say, "Hey Joe, what have you learned all those years in your job?" And I'll say, "I've learned this.
if I go on Monday morning and I don't mention the No Kings protest, I'm toast.
You are toast.
I am just toast. So we will talk about it. We'll mention it. I don't know. I mean, there's not a whole lot to discuss here other than the numbers, I think. I mean, I could. Look,
millions
what I
and
talk
millions
about,
of people took to the streets. And that's what's important.
And I don't care what side you're on, the signs were brilliant.
Yeah. Hilarious.
Signs are great.
Absolutely. I think I've read like 10 different articles that say, here are the best signs from the, and they're all one's better than the other. Yeah. They're just great. Outside of typical remarks from Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, and Mike Johnson, and a Fox News report, the Republican Party stayed mum. Mm-hmm. Staying silent as millions of Americans protest Trump on No Kings Day. They were mostly silent as No Kings rallies and marches against Trump administration policies unfurled on Saturday, many in the spirit of a street party that countered the Hate America depiction advanced by senior members of the party. Instead of provocation, there were marching bands and huge banners with We the People, references to the U.S. Constitution, and protesters wearing a lot of inflatable costumes.
Yeah. That's the thing.
Yeah, like pigs and cows, and it was great. A lot of frogs. Yeah. And which emerged as a sign of resistance. It was the third mass mobilization since Trump's return to the White House and came against the backdrop of a government shutdown that not only has closed federal programs and services, but is testing the core balance of power as an aggressive executive confronts Congress and the courts in ways that protest organizers warn are a slide toward authoritarianism. In comments Friday, Donald Trump opposed the protest organizers' characterization of him as a would-be monarch. They say they're referring to me as a king. I'm not a king, he said in a Fox News interview. Later Friday, a Trump campaign social media account mocked the protest by posting a computer-generated video of the president clothed like a monarch, wearing a crown and waving from a balcony. Then there was yesterday's video that he posted of, again, wearing a crown and taking an AI-generated, taking to the air and sludging the...
it was poop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He dumped poop all over the
people. The hundreds of thousands of people below. The president is putting his ego over responsibility with this disregard for public safety, the Democratic governor said in a statement. This is a different story. I apologize. I want to get to that. I'm reading the wrong thing. So at the White House event, Trump tried to downplay the No Kings event. I hear very few people are going to be there. Well, millions of people were there at places, and I know a lot of this is anecdotal. We have really no numbers. I will tell you that in my town, in southern Washington County, a red county, let's face it, the streets were full. Mm-hmm. It was unbelievable, and you see this like Andy Barowitz posted this, but like Boise. Like, good God, how many people were out in Boise? That's just fantastic. The other ones that I enjoyed, we talked about the enjoying of the signs. The other pictures I've enjoyed are the ones comparing the pictures of the crowds for the military parade versus the crowds.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, there is that.
Of the No Kings, I think that's amusing. But yes, it was a major event. From the people I talked to who were a part of it said, I always feel like there's nothing I can do, and I felt like I went out and I did something, and I bonded with people around me who are genuinely concerned about the future of this country.
Yes. I mean, we all are generally concerned. We couldn't make it because, you know, it's 2 weeks until Election Day, so I'm a little crazed. But, you know, from what I understand, there was from Manning Boulevard to Fuller, Stuyvesant Plaza in Albany, It was packed. Reports say that millions of people came out across the country. It's clear that there are people who are not happy with what's going on. For Michael Johnson to call this the Hate America rallies reminds me of when I was 10 and 11 and went to anti-war demonstrations, and they said, America, love it or leave it, right? Mm. Remember that?
Yeah,
well,
sure
we
do.
Won that. Mm. We won that, and we didn't leave, and we're not leaving now. And, you know, people just need to stay engaged.
Well, I mean, my feeling about this is that you're the Speaker of the House, you're the President of the United States, you're the Vice President. To lie about your constituents and about something that has yet to happen when it is your job, it is your mandate to represent these people and do well by them, that to me is the bigger problem. That shows that you have people in positions of power who do not respect their constituents, which means you don't take care of them, you don't care for them, you don't ensure their well-being, you don't ensure their safety. This is a democratic, like not capital D democratic, small D democratic issue.
But, you know, but and I agree with you 100%. What I found interesting, though, and I did think about this a lot over the weekend, was the big D democratic.
Mm-hmm.
I wish they were better at representing the small D.
All right. So here's my issue. Chuck Schumer, in your coalition, you have Raphael Warnock. Perhaps one of the greatest orators I've heard speak recently.
Agreed.
And you do not put a microphone in front of his face? Like, what are you doing? Chuck, you suck in front of a microphone. give it to somebody who can deliver a message.
Chuck is
now.
A little lawyerly.
Oh, God. Yes.
Well, I just think of it because I believe that so many people within in the Democratic Party will look and say, well, you know, are they being represented and why aren't they fighting more? And then you see this groundswell of people who are fighting.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
And why is that not being embraced more by a party leadership who say, these are the people who are ticked off right. And they want something done?
And the president says that the people who are protesting over the weekend don't represent America. Well, the fact is they do represent America. America, yeah. And they're all from all walks of life in America and in every community in America. And I think that's the takeaway here is that there is a groundswell of people who are supportive allies.
And Trump will lie at every opportunity. So you can't trust anything that comes out of his mouth. So to say that they don't represent America means they do.
Yeah. Right. I mean, but the thing about it, I mean, this is a stupid comparison, but I refereed soccer for a while. Right. And you have coaches you don't like working with. They're difficult. But you are still mandated to go there and give their team the best game possible and to
sure.
be respectful because that is your job. And I think that you know, politicians got to wake up and be like, hey, look, even if you won 60% of the vote, those 40% of people,
they're
your job
Americans.
Is still mm-hmm. your yeah. job to represent and do well by them, to ensure them a measure of safety and opportunity.
But the thing is, we have a president who sees everything as transactional and a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
So if they didn't vote for him, he's not going to protect them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to talk about the jewelry, the jewelry heist.
We're going to end with the jewels.
At the Louvre. I am fascinated by this story. I will admit I'm fascinated by this story. I think it's a horrible thing that was done. I think that, oh my God, George Santos is out.
Yeah, yeah. That's another yeah. horrible. That's really more horrible. Yeah.
I mean, I don't.
It's just astounding.
I saw that come through Friday night, and I was like, what?
It took him 3 minutes to get his first Cameo account back up running.
Of course, got to make that money.
Well, he got out like at midnight, and by 8 in the morning, he was on CNN. Yeah. Like, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, this is a president who lets felons off the hook, because if he doesn't, he'll be on the hook. I mean, it's just...
Yeah.
But going back to the Louvre for a
yeah,
moment.
Yeah, we'll talk about the Louvre. So
I said this before. It's like Ocean's 11 meets the Da Vinci Code. That's how I look at this, because these guys, I mean, I've watched all the Ocean's, you know, films.
Yeah, yeah.
These guys had this down mm-hmm. to the millisecond, and they stole crown jewels while everyone was sort of watching.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was bizarre.
The doors of the world's grandest museum had been opened to the public for just 30 minutes when two burglars were lifted up onto a second-floor balcony on the building's south side. Their faces concealed, they rode a truck-mounted electric ladder that is common sight in the streets of Paris, where it used to ferry bulky furniture through the windows of apartments. Once there, they used grinders to break a window, setting off the security alarms, and burst inside the Gilded Gallery of the Louvre Museum, where a prize collection of royal jewels and crown diamonds is held in a succession of cases. There, they smashed two cases, sounding more alarms, and snatched eight precious objects, including a royal sapphire necklace, a royal emerald necklace, and its matching earrings. The burglars went back down the ladder to a road shouldering the Seine and made their getaway with two waiting members of their team on motor scooters.
Mopeds.
Yes. You know, which is like just...
It's laughable.
It's just a scene out of any really good... what were the Matt Damon movies?
Born Identity. There's also a point to be made. There's a joke here about the French government having like five presidents in the last... Five months.
Yeah.
And then the crown jewels getting stolen.
Yeah.
Like,
okay.
there's a joke in there somewhere that someone smarter than me
I
is
thought you were
going
to go with Clouseau. But okay.
Is he when we need him?
That's right. It was the most brazen, possibly the most costly theft ever staged at the Louvre, which houses the country's most prized art collections. You know, Mona Lisa and such. French politicians publicly mourned the loss and railed against those they deemed responsible, loudly demanding to know how such a thing could happen at the world's most famous museum at 9:30 on a Sunday morning. The time that my wife and I went to the Louvre, we walked from our hotel to the museum, and we were panhandled and then pickpocketed. We came with like seven other tourists who made their way without. No, we were fairly, you know, we weren't silly about it. So, but we lost some cash, lost some jewelry, lost some. And it's just like, oh, so now it's happening on the inside too. But the one thing I will remember anything else is there was a sign in one of the galleries, and it said, and I'm paraphrasing, but it said, please be careful while reporting incidents of panhandling or theft to guards, as they may be the ones responsible.
Oh my God.
Amazing. Amazing. They're like, we don't pay these people enough, so they might rob you on the way in.
Wow.
Wow. In other words, welcome. Yeah. You're on your own.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it is an amazing story.
Yeah. Can I give you a hot take on this?
Yeah.
As much as the loss of beautiful cultural artifacts is a tragedy, maybe it's time that the crown jewels went. Maybe this wasn't the way for them to go, but maybe it's not the worst thing in the world that symbols of colonization that are viewed as French history went out the door in favor of things that actually represent that history a little bit better.
I mean, obviously, greed versus ideological concerns, but yes. Anyone else?
No.
What should cause alarm? People with masks on in the middle of the morning.
I know. It's an amazing story.
It really is.
An amazing story, and just how planned, and I know there'll be a lot of questions
I wonder you know, if the guards are the ones you have to watch out for picking your pockets. You gotta wonder.
You
if
know.
This was an inside camera.
Yeah. Somewhere in my camera roll, I have a picture of that. So it was actually more appealing to me than most of the art.
I thought that was in one of the stories, maybe the BBC, that there were questions about this.
It almost happened.
It was too easy.
Yeah. Well, my friends, we are out of time. My thanks to everybody who were here. Thanks to John for being with us, as always. Thanks to you thanks to our other three panelists for staying the full time. Bob Brigham, Justin Patch, and Libby Post, you are all wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us. And we will be back with more right after this.